a setting for you to imagine, if you would. Some of you may have had the pleasure of being down on MLK, having lunch, we'll say, at Champy's Fried Chicken. And you're there at Champy's Fried Chicken, which you're going to assume that I've been to a lot by my description. I've only been there once. But I hear people talk about it endlessly as if it is crack. And you're in Champy's, and imagine for a moment you looked around, and in there you're eating your three-piece white meat meal, and you've got your fried okra and some onion rings, and to level it out, some green beans. You got yourself a mason jar filled with iced sweet tea with too much sugar in it, as if that were possible. You're looking around, and everybody is messy and happy. There's no kale allowed in this restaurant. If it is allowed, it's smuggled under the cover of deep-fried costumes. And as people are eating and laughing, and all sorrow has been banished, and they've even forgotten that they're have taxes to pay, and they've got an important meeting after lunch. They're just sitting there, and their blood sugar is spiking, and their joy is overtaking them. And if you could be in that moment there, and you could look at it, and you could start to wonder about the various people who are all in the same spot, enjoying all of that culinary wonder, if it can be called that. And you realize that maybe if you could see into their lives, that you had in there somebody who beats his wife, is eating fried chicken, happy. You got somebody in there who's been cheating on their taxes. Somebody in there who just this morning cussed out their business partner and invited God to literally damn them by saying that lots of times. They, in that room, maybe people happy, eating as much sugar and fried lard as they want, and they're maybe not even thinking of God at all. There's no sign on the door that says to enjoy the bounty that God has given here, you must be one of loyal allegiance to Him. Anybody can have it. I think if you're going to understand Jesus' call to enemy love, to granting love to those who will not return it, to giving love to the one who hates, which is what an enemy is, then you're going to have to understand that Jesus has this picture in his head when he looks out at the world, when he walks out of the door in the morning, that he is inhabiting a universe that is superintended by his Father in heaven, who has created a world of which that little Champy scene is a microcosm. He's created a world in which he shows indiscriminate hospitality. He gives welcome and joy to all kinds of people who are never going to thank him. He gives unwarranted generosity. Generosity that isn't deserved, that isn't going to be repaid, for which he is not on the hook, to all kinds of people. You can go to Yellowstone National Park and have your jaw drop at the wonders of God's creation, and there is nobody at the gate checking to make sure that you're going to repay God with astonished awe at his creation and fall down on your knees and thank him for being such an amazing creator. Child molesters can go there. People who curse God can go there. Avowed atheists can go there. Anybody can go there. You can stand at a wedding and watch your wife come down the aisle, and you can enjoy the pleasure of kissing her on the mouth. Yes, I just said that. Whether you'll ever thank God for making her or acknowledge the one who gave her to you. God gives all kinds of kindness to the grateful, to the ungrateful and to the wicked, Jesus says. So be merciful as your Father is merciful. He is operating with a certain kind of vision. And before you can understand anything he says about loving your enemy, you have to understand that it is in the context of this vision. Because he says, this is what's happening in the universe. I'm asking you to replicate what's happening cosmically. What's happening from God in the heavens, I want to be replicated in the DNA of the people who have been adopted into his family through their faith in me. He says, when you love your enemies and you do good to them and you lend to them without expecting to get anything back, not only will your reward be great, but you will depict that indeed you show the family resemblance, that you are a child of your Father. And that's what Jesus is up to when he calls us to enemy love. He's wanting us to depict as a community in a world that is awash in verbal vandalism and toxic speech and toxic, poisonous, injurious, degrading action. He wants us to be a bright spot that says, look, God will love and accept and be generous and hospitable even to the undeserving, indiscriminately so. He's inviting you to swap your vision from what's normal for you. But I tell you who hear me, he says in verse 27. I tell you who hear me. I tell you who are listening to me. Take my words into yourself. Let them become the furniture in your mind. Let them populate your imagination so that you start to imagine that the world isn't merely to be acted in the way it occurs to you to act to it. The way it occurs to you, well, that happens everywhere. See how that's going. But we're people who have been acted on by God, and therefore we're going to inhabit the world in a different way. So we are trading in our values. We're trading in our vision for Jesus's. And he tells us this is the way to an indestructible life later on. If you build your life on his words, you'll be impervious to destruction. But I tell you who hear me, love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. You know, we're in this series called Divine Absurdities. We talked about washing feet, stooping, the Savior stooping to conquer through menial service, through the vulnerability of his giving his life. And we're looking over these weeks at this idea of the absurdities of God, where when God's kingdom breaks into the earth, when his administration is set up in a community's life, then there's all sorts of ways that we act that will seem absurd. There's all sorts of things that Jesus commands that when people hear them, if they're not loyal to him, if they don't obey him, then these things sound crazy. They sound vastly unreasonable. They don't make any sense at all. And this is one of the ones that makes the least amount of sense. Love your enemies. Do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. And pray for those who mistreat you. How does one love one's enemies? You know, this is a interesting command because for a lot of you, it's a lovely command. And the reason it's lovely is because you're not old enough yet to have any enemies. And so it's, as C.S. Lewis might say, so much idealistic gas. It's kind of like me driving down the highway with my father when I was about 16 and I was coming alive in my faith and I was memorizing scripture. And I knew when he was stressed and he was worried about many things, I knew Philippians 4 said, do not be anxious about anything, but everything in prayer and supplication. I'm surprised he didn't hit me in the mouth. And I said, Dad, you know, you shouldn't be worried about anything. Feels good. I wasn't a pastor yet. And I realize now the irony of saying, you shouldn't be worried about anything while I'm driving in a car that he's paying for and that my parents are going to work every day for a job that I don't have. Of course I'm not worried about anything. I didn't realize when you become a dad, that's all you do is worry about things. And one of the benefits of growing older, as I said a few weeks ago, maybe only three benefits to growing older. One of them is that you get to acquire enemies. If you live long enough and you're in enough relationships, at some point there will be people on the planet who wish you weren't. At some point there will be people on this planet who wish you weren't on this planet. And it's painful. And if you are a Christian, if you're following the way of Jesus, who was despised and rejected, who was called, surely you have a devil, who was called a blasphemer, who was crucified, if you follow this Jesus, you are guaranteed that people are going to hate you. Somebody, somewhere along the line, is going to be offended by the way that you act because your position, your goodness is going to show up their badness, and they can't stand it. But they won't know that's what's going on. And you may be hated for other reasons too. And so this is a lovely and nifty idea, like forgiveness, so long as you don't have any actual enemies. But when you have an enemy, then it's something you need to pay attention to. What is Jesus asking me to do when he says to love your enemies? And he repeats it at the end, but love your enemies. He sandwiches this, an Oreo of enemy love. What does it mean to do good to those who hate you? And he gives you some specifics that have to do with action, which is in itself significant and worth looking at. Martin Luther King said, it is significant that Jesus does not say to like your enemy, but to love them. He said, there are people that treat me in such a way that I don't like it. They talk to me in such a way that I don't like it. They do things on this earth that I do not like. I do not like them. But Jesus said to love them. And if you get nothing else out of this, one of the things that you can learn about managing yourself is that in this place, and when Jesus talks about forgiveness, and in so many other places, you can re-instruct your heart, which tells you that if you feel sorrow, anger, bitterness, resentment towards someone, that if you do good to them, that you're somehow being hypocritical. Some of you won't do a good thing for someone unless your heart is in it. You think that that's authenticness. But Jesus would call you to be hypocritical to your emotions. That in fact, the greatest acts of love are those that are done when your heart is not running along with your action. It's easy to love somebody when your heart is full, when you can't get over yourself of how much you're excited about them and how wonderful you think they are. It's very easy to serve somebody like that. But to wash the dishes for someone who just scolded you, to turn in and help and not malign your boss when he's just shamed you, well, those take a whole different kind of thing because you're operating against yourself. You have this animosity maybe. You have this anger maybe, and you're saying, I'm not going to obey my desire for vengeance. I'm going to obey my Lord and ask him to love this person, to do good for this person through me. And so he gives examples of what loving your enemy might be. And he says one way you would do that is do good. Do good to those who hate you. It's pretty open-ended. It means you got to think about it because you got to think about the situation. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you. These are three action things. Do good, bless, pray for. Years ago, I was in a little group of men who were meeting with Carter Crenshaw in Nashville, Tennessee. He was planting Weston Community Church. Some of you may know it. And we were working. We were all pre-seminarians. And we would meet before work and meet and talk to him and read books and things. And one day, his office, which was in a higher crime area of town, had gotten broken into, the church office, and several things had been stolen. The window had been busted out. And when I got there, I noticed that he had boarded up the window, and he had put a sign on the window. I thought, what are you, crazy? Who does this? And the sign said, to whomever stole from our office and broke our window, if you are hungry or if you need anything, will you please come and talk to us? Like, come on, man. Nobody's that spiritual. But he was taking it seriously. You know what he was doing? He was doing the thing we don't do when we hate people. He was doing the thing we don't do when we call someone our enemy. See, what's easy to do when you have an enemy, it says Miroslav Volf, is that you exclude your enemy from the company of humans who need mercy, and you exclude yourself from the company of sinners. You exclude your enemy. You say, he's not even a human. Someone who would do something like that is not even human. Somebody who would march on Charlottesville, they're worthy of death. Somebody who would hurt a child is worthy of death. They're not even a human. Wipe the earth with them. They're not even a human. We exclude them. And then you can hate them. And you can discard them. And you can rub them off the bottom of your shoe. And that's really working well, isn't it, culturally for us? Oh, people hate each other. And we exclude them from humanity who needs mercy. We exclude ourselves from being a sinner. It doesn't even occur to us sometimes, like, what might I do if I were in a bind like that? You know, most of the sins you have not committed are not because of your virtuousness, it's because you haven't had the opportunity. You don't know what you would do if you were pressed hard enough. You don't know. By God's mercy, most of us haven't been put in the situations that other people are. So he says, do good. Think of ways. How do I do good? Ask God when you have an enemy, how might I do good? Bless those who curse you. Some of you have people in your life who curse you. Literally, or they curse you by their icy effect. I was relieved to hear Dan Allender speak of someone in his church. I don't have anybody in my church, but I have people who literally, I can be 3 feet from them and say, hello. Hello, Quincy. I'm making up a name. And Quincy will act like perhaps only the air spoke. We could be face to face and this person will act like I'm not there. It's unbelievable and it hurts and it also makes me mad and it makes me confused. What's going on? And Allender says, I realized I had a person at church who would not look me in the face. They despised me. My wife said, it looks like as you're staying away from them, it looks like you're growing in bitterness. And he said, so I decided what I would start to do is just a gentle good morning. Good morning, how are you? That's what Martin Luther King tells his folks as he's preaching in this church in Montgomery about loving your enemies. He says, just be friendly to the one who wants to defeat you and keep being friendly to them. And at first, it might agitate them. At first, it might anger them. But you keep blessing them. And eventually, you may conquer them with your love. Jesus says, bless those who curse you. Do good to those who hate you. Pray for those who mistreat you. Years ago, I had the privilege of preaching at the National Memorial for the Unborn. It's a really sad place, but a place of redemption where these women who've had abortions they've known God's forgiveness, and they make placards for these children that they had aborted. And in preparation for that, I read the biography of Bernard Nathanson, who by his own admission had committed some 60,000 abortions and had been indirectly involved with some 75,000 abortions. He started NARAL, and he even aborted his own child from a woman he impregnated. He came to see that what he had done was wicked, that he was destroying the vector of life that started at conception. He started to be grieved and say, this is an awful Holocaust that we are participating in as a nation, and I've been leading the charge. He was overcome with the wickedness that he had been a part of. And eventually, he denounced abortion and started working against it. But you know what else happened? He eventually became a Christian. And you know how he became a Christian? He said, because these people, my pro-life friends, they were so kind to me, and they prayed for me. And they would pray for these doctors, and they would pray for these troubled women. They were so gracious to us. They were praying for someone who was doing something they thought was evil. And he was won over by love. And because they demonstrated a kind of mercy to him who had come to think of himself as a monster, he started to imagine that maybe God could have mercy on monsters. Pray for those who persecute you. Someone's being monstrous to you needs to know a monstrous mercy. This love for enemies takes the shape of being good, doing good to those who hate you, of blessing those who curse you, of praying for those who mistreat you. And then Jesus continues, if someone strikes you or slaps you on one cheek, turn to him the other also. If someone takes your cloak, don't stop him from taking your tunic. Give to everyone who asks you, and if anyone takes what belongs to you, don't demand it back. Do to others as you would have them do to you. Jesus is continuing, this is all a posture. And it's worth saying because this is one of those little idioms, these little expressions that people latch onto and they use very conveniently. Turn the other cheek. Turn the other cheek. You hear it a lot. Good. Jesus' words, stay alive. Now, I would say two things to you about this. When Jesus says this, he doesn't mean nothing. And when Jesus says this, he's not giving an absolute command for every situation that ever exists on the earth ever. When he says this, he's not saying nothing. Let's start with there. That's a good rule of thumb in general. When you don't know, what must he mean here? Always assume when the Bible teaches something, assume it doesn't mean nothing. Bonhoeffer, in an article that Professor Jones sent to me recently, said that one of the problems in the mainline churches, I think, one of the problems is that people have stopped reading the Bible against themselves and they're only reading it in their own favor. That's a great way of saying it. Which means the Bible is just a projection of what I already thought, not the book that reveals a Lord who's going to tell me what life is. The author of life might know more about it than I might, and which means he might have to correct me. My native assumptions. And so Jesus means something here. He's not toying around. He's not playing around. And he says, if someone strikes you on the cheek, turn to him the other also. And it begs the question, so what is that? What does that mean? Does that mean he wants us to be human punching bags? Does that mean if I'm a wife and my husband beats me up, I just stand there and keep giving him more cheeks to pummel? And to that I would say, no. One thing that commentators would say from looking at first century culture is that a slap to the cheek would be the equivalent of an insult. It would be a dishonoring thing. It wouldn't be an overly violent thing. It's a backhanded slap. We even have that idiom in our own language. I got passed over for that promotion after all that work I'd done. It was a real slap in the face. You ever said that? I heard someone say it. It's an insult. I've been dishonored. I haven't been properly esteemed. And so Jesus says, here's what you do when you're insulted and you're dishonored and you're not properly esteemed. Don't retaliate. Because that's what your natural instinct is to do. I'm rubber, you're glue, whatever you say, bounce off me, sticks on you. You hurt me, I hurt you back. And Jesus says, if someone strikes you, Don't retaliate. But he's giving us here a prohibition against retaliation, not a prohibition against confrontation. And you see that in his own life. One, when Peter talks about Jesus and his crucifixion, they led him like a lamb to the slaughter, but he didn't open his mouth. When they hurled insults at him, he did not retaliate, but he entrusted himself to God who judges justly. Jesus did not retaliate. He took the insult. He didn't run away. He took the insult. And he knew that if the insults continued, if the gross degrading of God continued, that one day God would settle the score. He didn't have to. And that's what you have to do to be able to not return insults. I have a really hard time at this when I feel threatened. I want to defend myself. But as we entrust ourselves to God and say our reputation, our honor depend on him, and we're worried that someone's going to get away with something, well, Paul says, leave vengeance to God. He will repay. See, because even though God is kind to the ungrateful and to the wicked, his kindness will run out. Do you realize this? If the ungrateful and the wicked stay ungrateful and stay wicked and never bow the knee to Christ and never receive the mercies of God, if they continue to stiff-arm him forever, then they will meet with the opposite of his kindness. That's why Jesus isn't so worried about what happens in this life, because this life is really short. He's worried about life in the world to come, preparing you for that, where God's going to make everything right. So any injustice you suffer now, any slaps to the cheeks, God can rectify. And nobody's going to get away with anything. As John Piper said, every sin is going to be judged either on the cross for you or in hell for those who will not accept Christ's work for them. So it's a prohibition not against confrontation, but against retaliation. And so one of the ways you might think about this is, look at Jesus again when he is struck in his trial on the face. Part of turning the other cheek in that case was not to retaliate, where he could have called down legions to destroy everyone, but he says to the high priest, if I spoke something wrong, then tell me what it was, but if I told the truth, then why did you strike me? He showed the offender. He showed the one who hates. He showed the one who's trying to intimidate and control. I'm not running away. I won't let you destroy. It's not a prohibition against confrontation, but retaliation. Dan Allender tells the story of a wife who does this as her husband is yelling at her. And she stands before him and says in an unshrill way, in an unangry way, honey, when you yell at me so fiercely, it reminds me how strong I know you can be. But when you try to bully me like this, it makes you look weak. She boomerangs. She turns and stands and she confronts, but she does not retaliate, so that he can start to see himself. That's love for an enemy or someone acting like one. But of course, what this cannot mean, because of all the other rest of parts of the Bible, that you're a good shepherd who fights for his sheep and will let nothing happen to them. You're a good shepherd who calls us to protect the vulnerable and the weak. This cannot mean that if you're a wife and you're getting beat up by your husband, that you should keep taking it. You need to get help. You need to ask for help. Come to somebody in the church. Go to the authorities. Do something. Don't just take it. No one should be beating you up. And of course, this cannot apply to governments whom God has given the sword for the exercise of authority for the suppressing of evil. Parents with children who have to exercise authority in their lives. It's not a prohibition against confrontation, but against retaliation. And Jesus keeps on and says, if you love those who love you, I'm going to try to move on here. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? And if you do good to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? And if, because even sinners do that. And if you lend to those from whom you expect repayment, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners expecting to be repaid in full. But love your enemies, do good to them, lend to them without expecting to get anything back. This idea of indiscriminate hospitality from God and unwarranted generosity from God, what Jesus says is, look, there is something native in all of you that knows how to sacrifice, that knows how to give without getting back, that knows how to show kindness that isn't going to be returned. You do it all the time in your tribe. You do it all the time in your immediate family. And he'd say, but so does the mafia. The mafia takes care of their own. There's no need or sense to think that the work of God is involved in this organized crime unit, this family of organized crime where they kill people who hurt their brother or their father or their mother. But he's saying, if you're going to mimic the character of your God who has this indiscriminate hospitality and this unwarranted generosity, then it's going to have to go beyond our own family patriotism, have to go beyond our own group, beyond the ones that we feel comfortable with. Those are the people who are going to need us to be good, to lend, to give to. To do that, of course, requires an operation of God in the heart. There's a story, and I'll close with it, of a rabbi who was relocated from New York City to Lincoln, Nebraska. And when he got there, he got a phone call, a message on his machine that said, "You'll be sorry you ever moved into that house, Jew boy." He was puzzled and frightened a little by this, and he waited, and sometime later he got another message that said, "The KKK is watching you, scum." And so this rabbi eventually came to learn that this man calling him was Larry Trapp. And so he got his number and he started to call Larry every week before the bar mitzvah class he was teaching. And he would call and leave what he called little love notes for Larry on his answering machine. Things like, "Hey Larry, there's a lot of love out here and you're not getting any of it. What's wrong with you?" He would leave notes like that on the answering machine. And one day, after many months, Larry picks up the phone and says, "Why are you calling me?" And he says, "I just want to talk to you, Larry." "What do you want to talk about?" "Well, I hear you're disabled, and I was going to see if I could take you to the grocery store. You know, since you called me Jew boy and scum." He didn't say that part. But he was saying, "Can I take you to the grocery," even though he's done those things? Larry said, "I got that covered. Don't call me anymore." But he kept on calling. And he kept on leaving messages. And one day, Larry called him. And he says, "I want you to come over here and get rid of all this white supremacist literature. I don't want to live in this poison anymore. I don't want to be like this anymore." And so this rabbi and this KKK guy began to become friends. And the lady telling the story said, "If it had ended there, that would be fantastic. What a story of God's overcoming grace." But Larry had kidney trouble, and he got really sick. And so the rabbi and his wife said, "Larry, why don't you come live with us?" And his wife quit her job so she could care full time for Larry, who called them Jew boy and scum. By the time he died, it was as if a family member had died. Your Savior calls you to enemy love in a toxic environment, because we have a God who has this generosity, who has this hospitality that he's shown us on the cross that says, you get to be mine even though you are my enemies. Because God's intent is to make enemies friends. And you never know what enemy out there, what monstrously acting person might be the apt beneficiary of the monstrously overwhelming mercy of God shown through you as Christ depicts it through you. This is our calling, the calling of enemy love. And we serve a God who that's all he does. He makes enemies friends. Now you and I, let's go do likewise. Amen.